approximately 33 billion years ago, something on the head of a pin, or well, about the size of the head of a pin, exploded. Now, don't ask me where that stuff came from, because it doesn't really matter. And it exploded, and it somehow, over a few billion years, filled up the universe with these humongous things. Don't ask me how they got to be bigger than the head of a pin, because I don't have an answer for that either. And then, about, I don't know, 23 billion years ago, this place that we call the Earth somehow caught on to a star and started orbiting around it, and there was this ooze there, and somehow this lightning struck or something, and all of a sudden this ooze gave birth to this little one-cell thing. Now, don't ask me how life comes from non-living materials, because even though science says it can't happen, it does. And then, after a little while, it grew to be 2 cells, and then 3 cells, and then it turned into fish. Some of those fish like being what they were, but some of them decided, you know what, I want to walk, even though they didn't have a brain yet. Don't ask me how that happened either. But some of them got feet and started to walk off, and then about 22 billion years ago, the Earth was covered with dinosaurs. Don't ask me how you get dinosaurs from one-celled organisms, and dinosaurs are bigger than a head of a pin anyway. Don't ask me that. It doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't need an explanation. You just have to take it on faith. Does that make any sense to y'all? It's going to last a little while, Alan. And then, a few billion years later, they finally died off because some big meteor hit the ground and made all this dust, and it covered the entire Earth, and the sunlight couldn't get through, and they all froze to death. And then, a few billion years after that, you know, within the last million years or so, somehow one of those fish turned into a human. Now, don't ask me how that happens either, because it doesn't really matter. Just believe that it happens. That's what an evolutionist is going to tell you about the Earth, right? Does any of those things I said make a lick of sense? Even though every one of those things is scientifically impossible, they believe in every one of them. And then, of course, what do? They chastise us for having faith in something they say we have no proof for. Even though we do have proof, and science shows that all of this, all the things that they claim, couldn't possibly have happened. Somebody, I don't remember who it was, wrote a book, "I don't have enough faith to be an atheist." In order to be an atheist, you have to have a whole lot more faith than it takes to be a Christian, because you got to have faith that goes against all the evidence. But as you read or hear the supposed history of the Earth, you'll hear things like billions and billions of years ago, these things happened, and dinosaurs have been extinct for millions, most of them say billions of years. When I was in school in sixth grade, our science textbook had a section on the Big Bang Theory, and it said the Earth was approximately 300 million years old. Since I was in sixth grade, they've decided it wasn't 300 million years, it's 22 billion years. Because they found so many problems that it takes longer to get to these certain points, they've had to extend the life of the Earth back even further to get all the things they're claiming to fit. Well, thankfully I had a sixth grade science teacher who, once we got to that section, he said, "Guys, this part is extremely stupid. We're going to skip it because I don't want to rot your minds with it." Now, you think somebody would get in trouble for saying something about something like that today in schools? Absolutely they would. But no human today has ever seen a living dinosaur. And because of that fact, evolutionists say, nobody's ever seen a dinosaur. They say humans and dinosaurs never coexisted. They never lived at the same time. And they of course say things like, dinosaurs would have been untamable anyway. In the book of Genesis, chapter 1, God brought how many of the animals to Adam to be named? Every one of them. And it wasn't until after the flood, Genesis chapter 6, that God said the animals will have fear of you, because now man was allowed to kill animals to eat. Seems, at least to that point, that animals and humans lived in relative harmony with each other, where one didn't kill the other and they didn't have to worry about things. After the flood, that all changed. The Bible flatly contradicts the theory of evolution. The Bible says the earth and everything upon it was created within 6 24-hour days, Genesis chapter 1. Now, it is true, dinosaurs did exist on Earth before man ever came on the scene. by a few hours, maybe. Depending on whether or not you want to say some of the dinosaurs were water creatures, that would have put them created on day 5. The land versions would have been created on day 6. Man was the last thing created on day 6. So at most, dinosaurs were on the earth for 24 hours before man was. Not 24 billion years, 24 hours. Dinosaurs were on Earth the same time man was. In Utah, see that's south. In Utah, it's northwest, right? Okay. In Utah, there are cave drawings there, some of which actually show a brontosaurus. At least that's the name I've always heard called for it. Some books give it some other names, but it's the one with the really long neck, the small head, and the extraordinarily long tail that they call thunder lizards and things to that effect. And those cave drawings date from less than 1,000 years ago. If dinosaur skeletons and the existence of dinosaurs from modern science didn't come into being for about 100 until about 150 years ago, that's when they first started discovering those dinosaur skeletons. In fact, the first one they found was a triceratops horn, and they said, well, it was a rhinoceros horn. Well, then they found the rest of it, decided, well, these are some new things we don't know about. How is it that if modern science didn't discover dinosaurs until 150 years ago, the people almost 1,000 years ago were drawing pictures of them on cave walls if they didn't know anything about them? What did they draw pictures of generally? They drew pictures of daily life, pictures of things that they saw. You can't have, we're going to get into this here in just a minute, but you cannot have a concept of something without having first been introduced to that. Imagine for a second, Wayne, I'll use you. Wayne, imagine for a second you have never heard of cheese. Never tasted cheese, never smelled cheese, never heard it referred to. And I ask you to get up here and describe cheese. Would you be able to do it? Having never heard of it before? No, of course not. As a side note, that is one of the ways that we can prove God exists. You can't have a concept of something, complete perfection, spiritual being, creator of everything. You cannot have a concept of that without having first been introduced to it, which means somewhere back in history, there had to be interaction between God and man. Otherwise, nobody would have a concept of God to pass on to us today. But we'll get to that here in a little bit. You ever read stories of knights in shining armor? What do they normally fight? They fight dragons. Now, you may say, well, all of those are made up. Well, it's interesting that almost every story that takes place in that time period and describes knights, they involve dragons not as something fictional, but they act as if it was really happening. And it's not just the stories from England. There are stories from all around the globe that date to about that time period that involve dragons. Either everybody was into mythical creatures, or maybe there were some around then. Something to think about. Is it possible that that's coincidence? Who knows? In Mexico, within the last 100 years, thousands of little figurines of dinosaurs were found. And contrary to popular science at the time, popular science said that dinosaurs walked on all fours and they drugged their tail behind them and they were slow-moving creatures. Contrary to that belief, these dinosaur figurines, a lot of them stood on 2 feet and used their tails as a counterbalance as they walked on their hind legs. And that's how those figurines were depicted. Well, it went against what science would have said at the time. Someone then came and said that somebody was falsifying these. They were faking them, making them up to try to prove that dinosaurs existed recently, and they said all of those were fake. Well, they found this house that was built 30-some-odd years before the guy that went down and discovered these figurines ever went down there. They tore down the house, ripped up the foundation, and guess what they found under it? More of those dinosaur figurines that the guy apparently had falsified. Somehow he buried them under... No, he didn't bury them. They were there to begin with. Now, we got this book here called Dinosaurs Unleashed. It's in the church. It came from the book room back there. It's got a lot more details about these things, including pictures of all those and who the guy was. And so if you want to happen to do a little bit more research into that, that's there. But how would somebody know how to sculpt these figurines? How to sculpt them in a way that accurately depicted how they would have walked without having ever seen them? Without having a clue what dinosaurs were? Now, these aren't just some figurines that are kind of blobs. These are pretty detailed. You know, it's a stegosaurus, I think, that has the little crest things all across its back. A bunch of different ones. Well, there's one of those. The Triceratops, and the one with the spikes on its tail, those are all there too. How would they know what dinosaurs looked like and how they walked, having never heard of them before? Well, obviously, somewhere along the line, they had to have been introduced to the concept of dinosaurs and what they were like, how they walked and how they acted, and the only way that could be done is if some living human at one point in history had seen a dinosaur and been able to pass on that information. Now, of course, what does all this have to do with Job, right? Turn your Bibles to Job chapter 40. We're going to be looking at Job chapters 40 and 41. Now, before we get into the main part of tonight's sermon, I'd like you to look at Job 40 verses 6 through 14. If you'll remember, last week, God asked Job, last week we talked about it. God asked Job about 70 questions, rapid fire, and finally Job's answer was, "I am vile. What shall I answer thee? I will lay my hand upon my mouth." Basically, Job said, "I don't have anything to say, I'm just going to be quiet." And then verses 6 through 14, then answered the Lord unto Job out of the whirlwind. Now remember, God is still speaking out of that big tornado. And he says, "Gird up thy loins now like a man. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. Wilt thou also disannul my judgment? Wilt thou condemn me that thou mayest be righteous?" You remember, that's what Elihu had been accusing Job of. He says, "Job, you're acting like God is unrighteous, but you're saying that you are righteous. You're saying you're more righteous than God." And God, here in this verse, is backing up what Elihu had said. Verse 9, "Hast thou an arm like God, or canst thou thunder with a voice like him? Deck thyself now with majesty and excellency. Array thyself with glory and beauty. Cast abroad the rage of thy wrath, and behold everyone that is proud, and abase him. Look on everyone that is proud, bring him low, and tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together, and bind their faces in secret. Then I will also confess to thee that thine own right hand, can save thee." Now, God again, speaking from the tornado, Job's already in awe of everything that's happened, realized based on all those questions that God had asked him before that he was wrong, he was vile, and he would have been humbled by that sight alone. But God asks him about his power. He says, "Job, can you disannul my judgment? Job, can you cancel out something that I've done?" Well, what's the answer to that? Of course not. Nobody can cancel something that God has declared. He says, "Do you have an arm or power like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his?" Now remember, when God asked this question, there's a tornado, and a tornado is extremely loud, right? And God's voice is even louder than that. He says, "Job, can you thunder with a voice like this? Can you be this loud so that everybody could hear you?" And then God tells Job to perform these great feats. He says, "Deck yourself with majesty and excellency, array yourself with glory and beauty, and then cast down every one of those proud people in your anger. Every one of them. Cast them all down right now. Show me you have that power, Job." Well, again, Job doesn't have that kind of power, and God is putting him in his place. Then he says, "If you can do these things, I will confess you have the power to save yourself." Well, Job can't do these things, and it lets us know that man is truly helpless without God. Man cannot save himself apart from God. Now, I know in Acts chapter 2, Peter said, "Save yourselves from this wicked generation, this untoward generation." Man does have a part to play, but without God, we can't save ourselves. We can save ourselves by taking advantage of the thing which God has offered. salvation based on following His commands. But we cannot do it apart from God. After again correcting Job's perspective, then God goes on to describe two beasts about which there has been untold volumes of speculation written about. He describes some massive beasts that man cannot control, but God can. The first one we're going to look at is called the behemoth. Job 40, verses 15 through 24. Now, the word behemoth is not a translation of the Hebrew word. Instead, all it does is change the Hebrew word, or Hebrew letters rather, into English. Had they translated it, we would have had a different word than behemoth. The actual meaning of the word in Hebrew is not exactly known. Nobody knows the exact meaning of the word. In 250 BC or thereabout, 72 Jewish rabbis got together and they translated the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek, into what we generally call Koine Greek, the common Greek of the people that was used at that time. In that translation, they used the word therion, which I know that just makes a whole lot of light bulbs come on for you. You know exactly what that means, right? Well, we'll get to that. That word means a savage, wild beast. It's not very specific. It doesn't tell you which beast is under consideration. However, I think it's interesting, and I'll point it out to you. In the book of Revelation, you've heard of the mark of the beast? The beast that is described in the book of Revelation in Greek is the same word that's used for the beast here. Now again, it just means a savage, wild, untamable beast, but it's interesting that the same word is used. And it'll be more interesting here in just a few minutes. But the word is also used twice to describe a snake. If you look at Acts chapter 28, verses 3 through 5, you may remember Paul is on the island of Miletus, and a snake comes out of the fire and bites him. And all the people there were sure he was going to die because it was an extraordinarily venomous serpent. And he just shook the beast off into the fire. Well, the word that's used there for that serpent is the same word as is used here, that beast. It's a wild, untamable, extraordinarily dangerous and deadly beast. And that word can be used to describe a great plethora of animals. So, in and of itself, the word behemoth and the Greek translation of it doesn't tell us exactly what this is. However, it's obvious from the way that God used this word here, that during Job's time, it referred to a specific animal. Job knew exactly what God was talking about. Job didn't say, well, God, what you've described, that could be any number of things. Job didn't say that. Job knew exactly what God was talking about. And if you were back there at that time, you would have known too. Some say God is describing a mythical creature. That cannot be the case. Look at verse 15. Behold now, behemoth, which I made with thee. God said, I made this creature with you. It is there with you, and I created it. Can God honestly, truthfully say that about a mythical creature? Something that doesn't exist. Can God say, I created something that didn't exist, and that thing that doesn't exist is right there with you? Well, of course not. It was an actual animal. Now, God goes on to describe this beast. He says in verse 15 that he is a grass eater. In verse 16, he says his strength is in his loins. Verse 17, he moves his tail like a cedar. His bones are strong like brass. Verse 18. Verse 19 lets us know that God is the only one who can approach him. God is the only one that can control or subdue this animal. In verse 20, we see that he eats on the mountains and he is unharmed by the beasts that go around there, that roam on the mountains. Verse 23 lets us know that basically he could drink up a river if he felt like it. In verse 24, snares cannot harm him. He breaks through them with his nose. You cannot subdue this creature. Now, what is the behemoth? Well, a lot of different people have given a lot of different guesses as to what is being described. There's a commentary I've been reading as I've been preparing these sermons, And he is thoroughly convinced that the behemoth is that extraordinarily scary, dangerous animal known as a hippopotamus. Okay? That hippopotamus that just causes fear in everybody. That hippopotamus, have you ever seen a hippopotamus's tail? You know what it looks like? It looks like a string. A rather thick string, but a little floppy string, about yay long. And of course, that is exactly like what God describes here when he says he moves his tail like a cedar. You catch how that's just not possible? If God says he moves his tail like a cedar, that means that tail is going to be substantial. It's going to be thick. It's going to be something that's stiff, like a cedar is. Hippo's tail, it's just kind of floppy. It bounces around. You've seen Winnie the Pooh, right? You know what Eeyore's tail looks like, the one that's nailed onto him? It's about the same thing. One of the ways hippos were captured was by piercing through their nose so that they couldn't breathe through their nose, and that would force them to open their mouth, and then when they opened their mouth, whoever was going after them could deliver a death blow. But in verse 24, God says you cannot catch it with traps, snares. His nose pierces through the snares. It doesn't say the snares pierce through his nose. It says his nose breaks the traps, the snares. Well, the way hippos were caught goes completely against what God says about this animal. Hippos actually can be subdued by man relatively easily if man bothers to put much thought into it. So the behemoth cannot be a hippo. Some believe it's an elephant. Again, I ask you to look at an elephant's tail. It's the same thing as the hippo's tail. It's a pig's tail is about the same thing if you straightened it out. It'd be just like the horse's tail. Elephants were tamed and domesticated, according to history, about this time. You couldn't describe an elephant as something untamable that would break through every trap that you could not capture. Because elephants were domesticated then. An elephant hardly describes an animal that only God could subdue. Other people say it's a rhinoceros. Well, again, look at the tail. That tail thing just kind of goes against what a lot of them say. But what about a dinosaur? Is it possible that God's talking about a dinosaur here? It says, has a tail like a cedar. Well, you know what a brontosaurus is, right? If you've ever seen the Flintstones, it's the thing Fred Flintstone sat on at the rock place whenever he was crushing the rocks. You know, big long neck with a head and a big long tail. Well, that animal was indeed a grass eater. He had a large, thick tail that he could swing around, which you'd be able to swing like a cedar. He would have had no problem drinking up vast amounts of water, as this animal is described as doing. Climbing mountains would have posed no problems, and the animals that lived on the mountains would have left him alone because, well, he's huge. Some of the skeletons they have found say that these brontosauruses could be 70 feet tall. Would you go trying to stir that animal up? I don't care if he's a grass eater. I don't care if he's not going to eat you. Would you go try to aggravate that animal? I know I wouldn't. It's bad enough seeing some of these dogs that are around town, let alone something, you know, huge. But its bones, the bones that we have found, were large. They were extraordinarily hard, like bars of iron. No animal that is currently living that we know about here on earth fits the description God gives of the behemoth. Dinosaurs, like the brontosaurus and some others, come really close. In fact, I've yet to find anybody that can say there's something about one of those dinosaurs that would not fit God's description. Now, if you go on to chapter 41, we read about another character. His name is the Leviathan. The word Leviathan, again, just like behemoth, is not a translation. They simply took the Hebrew words and changed them into English. So we have to go a little bit further to try to figure out what this animal is. In Greek, it's drakon, which dragon. It's where we get the word dragon from. In Isaiah 27 and verse 1, this same word, Leviathan, is used. And it's also, Isaiah uses two other words. A word that's translated serpent and another word that's translated dragon, and they all three refer to the same thing. The Leviathan was described as a serpent and a dragon. The same Greek word is used throughout the book of Revelation, and it's translated dragon. It's interesting that in the book of Revelation, the two fiercest creatures that the Christians could not withstand were the beast and the dragon. Yet the point of the book of Revelation, or one of the points, is that even though these things are terrible and the Christians are going to suffer from these two creatures, God is still in control of both of them. Here in the book of Job, God describes the behemoth and the leviathan, beast and dragon, if you look at the Greek, and he says, these are two creatures that man cannot control. Man doesn't dare try to take these beasts on, but I have control over them. Just something I thought you might find interesting, like I did, that the beast, or the behemoth and leviathan in Greek are the same words as the two fearsome creatures in the book of Revelation. But God goes on to describe the Leviathan. He says in verse 1, he cannot be caught with a hook or a cord or noose that somebody might let down. In verse 3, he says, will he make many supplications unto thee? Will he speak soft words unto thee? You know, you go after that Leviathan. Is that Leviathan going to beg you for mercy? Is he going to whine like a dog saying, you know, don't hit me? Leviathan's not going to do that. It's a rhetorical question. It will not plead with man. Verse 5, he says, will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you bind him for thy maidens? The Leviathan is not something you'd be able to capture and keep as a pet. It's not something that's domesticated. Verse 6, shall thy companions make a banquet of him? Or the companions, rather, make a banquet of him? Shall they part him among the merchants? The Leviathan cannot be caught and captured and used for food and cut up and sold in the marketplace, either as food or as clothing or anything else that you might think of. In verse 7, can you fill his skin with barbed irons or his head with fish spears? And the answer to all of these questions are no. So spears cannot affect this creature. Spikes have no effect on him either. Verse 9, behold, the hope of him is in vain. Shall not one be cast down even at the sight of him? Seeing this animal makes people afraid. Whatever beast it may be, the Leviathan strikes fear in people who see him. They are cast down. In verse 10, none is so fierce that dare stir him up. Nobody has enough guts. If they see this creature sleeping, none of them have enough guts to go try to wake him up. None of them. And then God says, in comparison to that, since no one is willing to stir him up, who then is able to stand before me? God says, if you're not even willing to face this thing because you know you can't stand against it, how are you going to stand up against me who controls this beast? Job was trying to stand up against God and act like God wasn't being just. God saying, you won't stir up this thing, and I'm greater than the Leviathan. How on earth can you try to stand up against me? But no one has the courage to stir that beast. And God says that everything under heaven is in his control. It says, who has prevented me that I should repay him? Whatsoever is under the whole heaven is mine. There in verse 11. In verse 13, you see about the Leviathan, nobody can bridle him. You can't put a bridle on him and ride him like you would a horse. You can't control him that way. In verse 14, who can open the doors of his face? That's talking about his mouth. His teeth are terrible round about. Nobody can force his mouth open. Nobody would want to be completely honest. His scales are so seamlessly together, they cannot be parted. No air goes through them. You can't see the seam of them. Verses 15 through 17. Verse 18 says, by his kneesings, a light doth shine, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. His eyes seem to glow. That's what that's saying. It's like his eyes are glowing. He breathes fire from his mouth, smoke from his nostrils. Look at verses 19 through 20 or 21 rather. Out of his mouth go burning lamps, and sparks of fire leap out. Out of his nostrils goeth smoke, as out of a seething pot or cauldron. His breath kindleth coals, and a flame goeth out of his mouth. Sound scary? It was to the people back then. In verse 22 it says, in his neck remaineth strength. Sorrow is turned into joy before him. Whenever he sees people scared in front of him, that makes him happy, because he instills fear in all of them. His neck is extraordinarily strong. They cannot grab it around the neck with ropes or anything else and try to force it to turn this way or that way. With a lot of animals, you can put a leash around them, like a dog. You put a leash around a dog's neck, and then whichever way you pull, that's basically the way the dog has to go, right? Not so with the Leviathan. They couldn't do it. His scaly skin is firm, and it cannot be forcefully moved. There in verse 23, the flakes or folds, some versions say, of his flesh are joined together. They are firm in themselves. They cannot be moved. You cannot move the skin of this animal. In verse 24, it says, his heart is firm as stone, yea, hard as a piece of the nether millstone. A millstone was extraordinarily hard. It would not break. He says, his heart is that way, the Leviathan's heart. And that means that animal has no fear. Nothing can make that animal's heart melt. He's not scared of anything. In verse 25, it says, when he raises up himself, the mighty are afraid. By reason of breakings, they purify themselves. You know what that means? At least what some people who have studied the Hebrew say that means. It means whenever that animal rises up, even the mighty men fill their britches. They purify themselves. Do you realize how horrible, how scary that creature must be? That God says, even the mighty men are that scared. Says in verses 26 through 29, if you were to attack it with iron weapons or brass weapons, the strongest metals of the time, he would esteem them as straw or rotten wood. It says in verse 28, the arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned with him into stubble. Darts are counted as stubble. He laughs at the shaking of a spear. Sharp stones are under him. He spreadeth sharp pointed things upon the mire. Even if you put those things, those spears and things underneath him, he would just knock them out of the way like they're nothing. You can't capture him. His underside would not be penetrable as well. In verse 30, that's what we just read in verse 30. In verse 31, it says, he makes the deep to boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. Now, possibly that means he heats it up with his breath and he could make the water boil just by flames from his mouth. Some also believe this may refer to the fact the animal could probably swim underwater and churn up the water and make it extremely tempestuous and bubbly because it swims around so fast, stirring up the water. But in verses 33 and 34, it says, upon earth there is not his like who is made without fear. That animal doesn't fear anyone. He beholds all high things. He is a king over all the children of pride. No earthly creature, no person can control this animal. Now, if you remember, God says everything under the whole heaven belongs to him, back in verse 11. God still had control over this beast that even the mighty men were afraid to approach. Now, what is this beast? What is this Leviathan? Well, the commentary which I mentioned earlier said that this is referring to the extraordinarily large, scary, untamable crocodile. He said, I am convinced the description of Job 41 admirably fits the crocodile. Crocodile is very susceptible to swords and spears. And I don't know if you've ever seen anybody doing alligator wrestling before, but you know what they do, right? They hold the mouth shut. And it's very easy to do so. Alligators' jaws are not that strong to open their mouth, but their muscles are set up extremely strong to close. Opening them is no problem at all for a man to do. Yet God says, this beast, you can't open its mouth. You can't force it open. Also, the underside of a crocodile is very easy to penetrate. Crocodiles fear humans with weapons. It's easy to kill one if you're careful. Mighty, yeah, because you don't want to get your hand bit off. So you got to be careful about how you do it. But it's not that difficult for those people who know how to do it. And also, crocodiles don't breathe fire. There's, you know, some of those little details just kind of don't fit. Well, one lexicon said that a whale, the leviathan, is a whale. Well, you know, think about it for a second. A massive whale comes out of the water. You think that caused fear in a lot of people? Sure. But have you ever heard of a fire-breathing whale? I know I haven't. But how would you even have the opportunity to stir a sleeping whale? It says none of the mighty would dare stir him up. None is so fierce that they would dare stir him up. That assumes that you could actually ever see this beast sleeping. How are you going to stir a sleeping whale? Because they're kind of underwater. We can do that. Well, that goes against what God has said. Spears easily pierce the flesh of a whale. You know what they use to kill whales? Harpoons. And what do the harpoons have? Spears. It's very easy. And from a long time back, they would kill whales. They would eat the meat. Just so that they wouldn't be able to eat the meat of the leviathan. And then they would cut it up. They would sell whale skin. They would sell the blubber as oil for lamps. The whale doesn't fit this at all. Does the sight of a crocodile, though, make mighty men lose control of their bodily functions? Because that's what it says the leviathan does to the mighty men. Is it possible, just maybe, that a dragon is under consideration? What we would typically view as a dragon. Maybe. Think about this, though. 2,361, approximately, years ago, when the Hebrews, the Jews, translated the Old Testament into Greek, they chose to describe the Leviathan as a dragon. They know a little bit more about Hebrew 2,300 years ago than we know about Hebrew today. They most likely would have known what that word meant, or at least had a whole lot better idea what it meant than we do. And they would have, whenever they translated it, they would have given the most accurate description that they could have based on their knowledge of their own language that they spoke. If I say dragon in English, you know what that means, right? You could describe that to somebody, couldn't you? Because it's your own language. You understand the word. Well, the Hebrews would have understood what this word meant, or at least, again, had a better idea than we did. But the idea that we have traditionally of a dragon, fire-breathing dragon, humongous, possibly flies, could also go in the water, that would fit the description of this very well. Imagine, though, seeing an actual large fire-breathing dragon. Would you be scared? I mean, not one like it's shown on some movies where the dragon is some sort of pet or is friends with a human. No, these dragons didn't care at all. They would go after anybody that came around them and wouldn't fear them at all. Now, would you be scared? Absolutely. There are also some large dinosaurs which are similar to a Tyrannosaurus rex, and they have this crest on the top of their head. And according to some skeletons, that crest itself could have been about 7 feet tall. And it had two chambers in it. Now, they've made all sorts of guesses as to what that could be. It could be this hollow chamber that allows them to make some sort of really loud roar or real loud mating call. But it also is interesting. Have you ever heard of the bombardier beetle? Bombardier beetle has within itself two chambers of two different kinds of chemicals. When those chemicals come together, and they do this, they get those two chemicals to come to the mouth and they spit it out, and as soon as those two chemicals get together and are exposed to oxygen, you know what they do? They explode. They are fire-breathing beetles. I kid you not. You can look it up online and it'll just tell you all you want to know about it. It's also possible then that this dinosaur, which is similar to the Tyrannosaurus rex, which was just massive and had that crest on there, was possibly a fire-breathing dinosaur. It is possible, and that may be also what's being described. Now, as a side note, you've heard of a cherubim. You know what cherubim is? Well, cherubim is nothing more than the Hebrew plural word for cherub. They didn't put S's at the end of it. They put the letters I-M. So a cherubim is actually just more than one cherub. And what is a cherub? Well, it's a little naked baby angel, right? Well, cherubim in Hebrew, literally, as best as we can tell, means fire snake. And a lot of people are convinced that a cherubim may be the same thing that's described here, possibly a reference to dragons. Don't know for sure, but it's an interesting side note. Just something to think about and spend countless hours on the internet researching so you can try to make up your mind. If you're anything like me, those things just grab your mind and you just have to keep reading. Now, does it really matter what the beasts are? In the grand scheme of things, is it going to matter whether or not you go to heaven or hell based on you know what the behemoth is and you know what the leviathan is? No. It's something, though, that we need to realize. God is over even the most dangerous, scariest creatures on this earth. There is nothing on this earth that God does not have control over. So, no matter what goes on in your life, you may not have power over, but God does. Therefore, we should trust in Him. We need to put our faith in God, who created everything. Those things that are alive today and those things that are extinct. God's the one that created all of them. And again, if you look at the book of Revelation, the same general idea is spoken. God is in control of everything, even the governmental powers that may be giving us fits, or the religious powers that may be giving us fits. And in the book of Revelation, most likely that's referring to Jerusalem and the Jews that were the constant thorn in the side, even killing Christians. But God is still in control. God is in absolute control. And also, we need to realize there is ample evidence that humans and dinosaurs existed at the same time, and that evolution is a bunch of hooey. It's goofy. I don't know what other fun words I could use to describe it. It's pointless. It's stupid. We need to realize there's ample evidence that dinosaurs and humans lived at the same time. How else could humans draw pictures of something they had never seen, never heard of? Well, they couldn't. If I asked you to close your eyes and imagine the worst possible creature, and maybe even write out a description of it, tell me all about this horrible, awful creature, you may come up with something that nobody has ever seen before as far as put together, but every single thing, every single aspect of that creature is something you've heard about before or seen before. We did this experiment in class when I was in preaching school. Chuck Northrup asked us to just start describing the worst creature imaginable, and he said, "It's got breath that could knock you over. His breath is just that bad." Well, is that something that's never been thought of before? Of course not. 80 feet tall with black wings. Well, have you ever seen anything with black wings? Yeah. Do you have a concept of what 80 foot tall is? Yes, you do. However, nobody would have had a concept of dinosaurs existing at all had they not experienced them, had they not been able to see them at some point. One theory about the building of the pyramids is that humans at one point in time had domesticated some of the dinosaurs and were able to use them as labor. It's interesting that the Sphinx and the pyramids have evidence on them that at one point in time they were underwater. There is a lot of water erosion on the Sphinx, and some geologists have independently verified, yes, I'm looking at a picture of water erosion. And then they were shown the rest of the picture, which was the Sphinx, and that kind of went against their whole idea of a global flood, and so they kind of backed off from their statement. But dinosaurs possibly helped even to build the pyramids. There are carvings in China from about 1,000 years ago that show humans riding on some dinosaurs, shows that kings were pulled along the streets by dinosaurs actual dinosaurs like the ones we have skeletons of today. Again, how would they be able to draw those things in such perfect descriptions? Modern science didn't even know they existed until 150 years ago. The only way they would have known to do that is they would have had experience and seen those things. God describes dinosaurs, or something very much like them, as a reality in the book of Job.